What happened to music that meant something?
The Who at the Kingdom or Kiss at the Coliseum. Where is the Misty Mountain Hop? Where is the Smoke on the Water? Where is the Iron Man of today?
Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kutz. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I are going to review two of the most heavily anticipated albums of the year, from 50 Cent and Kanye West.
Then it'll be Greg's turn to pop a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
Greg, this is the 93rd public radio installment of Sound Opinions, and for 93 weeks here, we have been covering the slow and painful death of the music industry. Everybody wants to know, what does the future of this industry, what's it going to be, right? We have two stories this week that are offering two different views from two people who are renowned record men. I think it's worth mentioning first, before we get to those, Bertelsmann, the biggest music publisher in Europe, one of the four big major labels left standing, has posted a phenomenal loss recently, $69 million, bailing out all of those lawsuits from Napster. If you recall, Napster was the first big file-sharing program. It was the vision of this kid who started it in his dorm room, Sean Fanning, give away music for free, right? That's one model of what the future of the industry is going to look like. However, Bertelsmann invested in this company just before it went bankrupt, and instead of having this new tool to take them into the new age, all they wound up with was this incredible debt from these lawsuits. All the major labels, if you recall, Metallica and a lot of major label bands sued Napster for giving away their music for free. Clearly, that's not the model that's going to take over the new music industry. What is? One interesting piece was in the New York Times this week, offering Rick Rubin's view.
Exactly, Jim. There was this cover story in the New York Times Sunday magazine by a veteran writer, Lynn Hirschberg, detailing the vision of Rick Rubin, who is posing on the cover, can Rick Rubin save the music business? So what is the future of the record industry, according to Rick Rubin? Well, I think there's a couple of interesting points here, Jim. First of all, Rick Rubin is a guy who comes from a heavy, heavy music background. His entire career has been spent producing records by artists like Johnny Cash, Slayer, The Beastie Boys, LL Cool J.
Started Def Jam, speaking of dorm room entrepreneurs, started Def Jam in a dorm room at New York University.
Exactly. He is a music guy. For the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, the music industry has moved away from music guys running the big labels. Eric Nicoli, the guy who just got fired at EMI Records, was a guy who came from food manufacturing.
Right,
he tried his hand at EMI for the last 6, 7 years. EMI has been losing money hand over fist. Rick Rubin now has been appointed the new head of Columbia Records. They're returning to these music guys. What is the future of music? Well, Rick Rubin is saying the future of music is music.
Yeah.
Let's put the emphasis back on the content. Let's put the emphasis back on the art. One other thing that Rubin is suggesting in this article is that he thinks the future of the music business is a subscription-based model. People are going to pay like $19 a month and get all the music they want, anywhere they want, on these little handheld devices, probably similar to iPods, but much more far-reaching, and be able to get any song at any time, anywhere they want, for $19 a month.
Well, you would subscribe to Columbia
right.
Records, and then anything they put out, you would get. I guess you would have to subscribe to all the different major
labels.
Well,
see, there's the flaw in that, right?
Right, yeah, because who cares what record label is putting out the music you like?
And he's assuming that the four big labels, not to mention all the independent labels out there, are going to come to an agreement to pool all their resources in one centralized location where that music can be accessed. I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't know if that's a realistic goal.
It's a dubious vision. I would also argue, Greg, that Rubin's reputation as, I mean, you know, in the record industry, the biggest compliment you can give a guy like Rubin or Clive Davis is they have ears, right?
Yeah.
For the last century, that was the golden compliment.
Right.
They have ears. Rubin's been responsible for a lot of crap, too. I mean,
sure.
He put out the Ghetto Boys. He put out Andrew Dice Clay. And some of the acts he's excited about now that he's running Columbia Records, well, one of them, I'm way behind, The Gossip, this incredible punk rock explosion. Is it going to sell records? Heck no.
Yeah.
You know, but I love The Gossip.
Yeah.
The other one, he's all excited because one of the old line execs at Columbia had heard on Britain's Got Talent this artist that he was all excited about. This guy singing opera. That's this guy, Paul Potts, who made a splash on Britain's Got Talent. And Ruben was moved to tears, according to this endless... And this article is making such a splash, we have to note. It's got to be 50,000 words long.
Yeah.
It's so rare to see a piece this extensive in the New York Times or any major American magazine about the state of the music industry. So the entire music industry is buzzing about this. But I think at the bottom of all this hoopla is, like, you know, Ruben really doesn't have a plan. And Ruben's taste is dubious, because he's also excited about Neil Diamond, and that record sucked. We reviewed that.
Well, I think it's interesting to see what Alan McGee said, a man who's responsible for some of the greatest music of the last 20 years, the founder of Creation Records in the UK. I think he had a more realistic idea about what the future might be.
Yeah, absolutely. McGee is another guy who has ears. He brought us Oasis. He brought us My Bloody Valentine, all of those English shoegazer bands of the 90s. And I think that for a while, Creation was as successful in the UK and in the alternative era as Def Jam had been in the birth of hip-hop. McGee says, quite simple, nobody wants to pay for music anymore. Let's give up this whole idea. The model has changed. He wrote an editorial for The Guardian, a newspaper in the UK, and said, you know, there are some people who still collect records. His son is one. Mm-hmm. His son apparently collects vinyl 45s from 1981. But McGee says there's never going to be a future of the industry based on that model anymore. The only thing to do is to give away new recordings for free, and money will be made on concert tickets and band t-shirts. Mm-hmm. And that is the future of the model. All the music is just an enticement to come see the band live and to buy their merchandise and to invest in them in other ways. The problem with this, of course, is this is a man who had one of the most successful independent record labels in the last 30, 40 years, mm-hmm. there's no need for record companies, right?
Right.
McGee says the bands will thrive. You know, they're not going to have a problem, but record companies and Ruben will.
I think that what the model is, the record companies become a marketing company. They put out the music. It's for free. They make it as widely available as possible, but they share in the revenue streams of the touring and the merchandise. And that's the way that a record company can thrive with an artist in the future. Stop wasting my time. Spinal Tap singing about Give Me Some Money. And Jim, we've talked a lot about how people get paid in the music industry in this segment, or how they're going to get paid. Well, one of the ways that artists get paid, one of the most reliable ways for them to get paid, is the U.S. Performance Rights Organizations, the three big U.S. Performance Rights Organizations that distribute money to songwriters who have their songs performed.
ASCAP, BMI, CSAC.
BMI, one of the big three, just distributed more than $732 million in royalties to songwriters. A huge, huge revenue stream that looks like it's going to become a key to the future of the music industry.
Well, despite this cash rolling in, ASCAP, the biggest of the three, I believe, has announced lawsuits of 26 different nightclubs, bars, restaurants in 17 states, a major crackdown with the goal of getting more of these small venues to pay more money for playing music by its artists in its joints, right? We're going to hear from a local bar owner in a little bit, but we wanted to talk to ASCAP's Vice President and Director of Licensing, Vincent Candeloro. Mr. Candeloro, is the goal of this new initiative just to remind people what the law is?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, let me first state that we do that as absolutely a last resort. I mean, ASCAP is owned by the actual songwriters and music publishers. And they want every dollar that we spend pretty much, you know, going out to them in royalties. So we try and operate at a very low operating ratio. Suing establishments is the last thing that we really want to do. Unfortunately, it's something that we find ourselves doing on somewhat of a regular basis.
Yeah. Now, a lot of these are fairly small places. I mean, you know, Greg and I are the rock critic at the at Rock Critics at the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. I've never been to the O'Hare Gaslight Club in Chicago. Have you, Greg?
No.
Hardly.
Not lately, anyway.
I think it's safe to say, no offense to that establishment, Vincent, that it's hardly a hotbed of cutting-edge music in Chicago. What
they
is
are smaller. They are smaller venues, and I can attribute probably the reason that that's who we wind up having to sue, simply because that they are... I guess the best way to describe it is to say that they think they're little fish and we have bigger fish to fry, so that they can get away with it and they won't be sued.
In most of these cases, are you alleging that musicians got up and were playing cover songs of artists and the venue wasn't paying the rights, or were they just playing CDs or jukeboxes or the radio?
In the overwhelming majority of the ones that we sued, the live music was being performed, but as a matter of law, it doesn't matter whether they're playing a CD or whether it's a karaoke performance, whether it's a band, it's still the public performance of a musical composition.
A copyrighted song, is
sure.
what you're saying.
Yep.
And what you're saying, too, is that how would the establishment keep track of this? Do they pay a licensing fee at the start of every year or at the start of every month, or are they expected to keep track of each individual song and then
pay per song?
How does it work?
That's really the beauty of it, and that's why ASCAP was created. Since the copyright law more or less puts the onus on the user of music to obtain the permission from the copyright owner, you know, what you're talking about in theory is, wow, if I own a bar and I'm using music, copyrighted music, I got to find every copyright owner and get their permission and then negotiate what fee they're going to charge me so I can use their music and be in compliance with the copyright law. Well, that's why all the songwriters came together and formed ASCAP back in 1914. So, to answer your question, no, they simply pay us a fee, which is a blanket license fee, meaning they can use any of the 8.5 million songs that we represent. They can use them as many times as they like. And they pay a flat fee based on what we feel are fairly logical licensing factors, and if we're talking about the public performance, so what's the size of the public? What's the seating capacity? So if you've got 75 seats, 100 seats, there's no cover charge, you're just, you know, using music in that manner, you're probably going to pay about $1.50 a day.
Of the $1.50 a day, how much of that goes to songwriters?
Okay, out of every dollar that ASCAP collects, 88 cents goes to our songwriters. We do not make a profit. We operate at a 12% operating ratio, which is the lowest of any of the performing rights organizations in this country.
Mm-hmm. But, Vincent, we have to remind people that there are three performers' rights organizations. ASCAP is the biggest, probably the best well-known. So you have these three organizations basically hitting up a tiny bar who's got some jamoke from around the corner coming in with an acoustic guitar, and he plays for 4 hours for a tip hat, and he does one Beatles song.
Right.
Now, you know, so $350 a year times three.
Now, do you really think that that's the only music being used in these places?
No, I don't. No,
I mean,
no,
what do they play when he's not on?
Well, that's another question. When somebody just puts the CD player on, they've purchased the CDs, let's say, and of course, part of that money is reverting to the songwriter.
You know how much of that money is reverting to the songwriter?
The tiniest part of the pie.
It comes out to less than 0.1% of the gross revenue that the record company sees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so everybody thinks that it's kind of that Robin Hood mentality. Anybody who writes a hit song must be a millionaire. You know, so how could I be hurting him by playing a CD in my establishment? That's why the copyright law exists, so that these songwriters can earn a living. Not all of them are Bruce Springsteen.
Can you give us a number of how many establishments, business establishments, actually have these licenses with
hundreds? ASCAP? I mean, hundreds of thousands. And it's a business expense. I mean, if you owned a restaurant, I'd walk in there and you're going to argue with me that people are coming to your restaurant because they like your Italian food. They don't come for the music. And then I'd ask you, do you serve parsley? Well, it's not on the menu. I don't see a price for it. But the restaurant owner has no problem paying for parsley. Why? Because he knew somebody planted it, somebody watered it, somebody shipped it to him? No, he pays for it because they'll stop delivering it if he doesn't. We can't do that. We can't stop people from buying CDs. We can't stop people from hiring bands. And that's why they try and get away without paying for the property that they're using. That's why ultimately, unfortunately, we wind up having to sue them.
Mm. All right, we've been talking to Vincent Candelora, the VP and Director of Licensing at ASCAP. Thank you very much, Vincent. We appreciate you coming on Sound Opinions.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
To get the bar owner's perspective, we turn to Mike Miller, who owns one of the coolest drinking establishments in Chicago, the official rock and roll hangout, Delilah's. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing real well, Jim.
I have never been into Delilah's where I haven't heard over the course of an evening at least two or three songs that got me absolutely jump up and down excited. You guys have great DJs. You occasionally have bands. How do you have to pay for that when you deal with the rights organizations?
Well, you know, we're licensed ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. When you get the bill, you never feel all that good about it. But okay, we're clearly supportive of the music scene and clearly supportive of the local musicians and stuff. And I'm for that. I've talked to several of my band friends about this issue as well, and everybody has a gray answer. Everybody wants to get paid, but everybody thinks, you know, maybe the music is being put on the back burner in favor of the business side of things.
You know, Greg and I hear a lot of music. I have literally been to Delilah's where I've heard stuff that has made me go out and buy that album. Now, if you can do that to me, one could argue that you're turning as many people onto music as radio stations.
Well, one could argue that maybe they should be paying me.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Right.
Well, all right, Mike, let's put some money on the table. What kind of fees are you paying to these three organizations?
I think ASCAP is $1,500.
Yeah.
BMI is a little less, maybe $800,000.
Mm-hmm.
I think CSAC, I pay about $300. So is that about $3,000 a year?
The other thing here, if you're a music fan, you're wondering, okay, where does this $2,600, $3,000 end up? Does it actually end up in the pockets of the people who wrote these songs?
You know, if I'm a painter, I paint my painting, I sell my painting to somebody, they own my painting, deal's done.
Right?
If I'm a musician, I create a song, I put it out there to the world, how do I get paid? I think it's a legitimate concern, and it should be monitored, and bands should get paid. But the question is, where does the money go, and how does the money get back to the band?
Yeah, it's almost impossible. It's almost like you'd have to hire somebody to keep a record book, a running log of every song that's played, and give that to ASCAP. And that would be a bureaucratic nightmare for you, which would compound the bureaucratic nightmare that they have right now. Yeah,
it would end what we do, which is for fun and to promote music and to draw people in and show them things other than what's commonly available on the marketplace.
So there's no way to do this, is there, Mike? It doesn't seem like there's a reasonable way to do this.
Like I said, you know, it's a huge behemoth. How do you solve it? I'm not against the companies that are collecting the funds. I think the question is, how do they better disseminate the money out to the artists? And is there something, you know, out there that could be promoting the growth of music and using the money as a promotion of the live music scene and to, you know, especially as we're seeing the sales of records sink, should ASCAP be going in and spending money helping to promote record stores to stay in business? Yeah, maybe, because do the White Stripes need that check, or do the Peelers need that check?
Well, no, and at the end of the day, Mike, the thing that Greg and I keep finding out is that the more technology advances, the simpler the bottom line in the music industry gets. The guy who walks in with his guitar to Delilah's and plays for an evening and gets $200 in his hand at the end of the night along with a shot of Maker's Mark, I mean, that's still the way musicians make 99.9% of their income.
Bingo.
Yeah.
And I think in a weird way, that's how they want to make their income.
Yeah, it's about playing music for people.
Yeah, and on the flip side, the music industry is hemorrhaging money. They're not making money from the CD sales to the extent that they were 5-6 years ago. So they're looking for a new revenue stream. So they're going to come to these bars more often and shake them down and say, you know, here's the licensing fee. Give us your $2,000, $2,500, $3,000 a year.
And I'm okay with paying it. So let me be clear. I'm okay with paying that fee. I would just be a little. I would prefer to be a little more clear on where's the money go.
Mike Miller from Delilah's, as always, a pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thanks, guys. You guys keep up the good work over at Sound Opinions.
Coming up on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, reviews of the new albums from Kanye West and 50 Cent. You're listening to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
Look how you're talking to me like Kanye West is my equal right now. It's like me putting myself in Michael Jackson's date and then acting like, whoa, it's a battle between 50 Cent and Michael Jackson. When Thriller sold 30 million records and 50 Cent, biggest album sold 12. I think it's cute for him to try to put him next to me and actually make a comparison. There's no comparison. You got the worker bee going against the boss.
Greg, that is New York rapper 50 Cent talking about his competition at the top of the charts with Chicago rapper Kanye West. I think this is a fascinating story, and granted, much of this is hyped in the press, okay? Third album from both of these hip-hop superstars coming out on the same day. They're going head-to-head. 50 Cent has said that if Curtis, his album, does not sell more than Kanye West's Graduation, that he will retire from the music business. Kanye's been backing away. You know, said, I don't see myself in competition with him. I'm in competition with Justin Timberlake, who is the best-selling black artist of the last year. You know, Timberlake is not African-American, but Kanye's point was that this guy is having this crossover appeal. Meanwhile, people in the industry say Kenny Chesney, the Country Hat Act, may outsell both of them. I do think that there is a really interesting thing here in that both of these albums are highly anticipated by lovers of hip-hop and by anybody who's paying attention to pop music in general, because these guys are giants in their field, and I think that this represents, in some ways, a clash between two art forms. You know, 50 Cent is the reigning gangster rapper of the moment. You and I have criticized gangster rap for a long time on this show for being played out artistically, just having become a musical and lyrical cliche. 50 Cent, famously, you know, I've been shot 29 times, been stabbed 100 times. You know, that's his whole shtick. Kanye West represents something pretty new and different. I think that in a lot of ways this is a showdown between two art forms as much as it's a showdown between two artists.
I agree, and I think it's critical time for the music industry, as we've been saying throughout the show, throughout the history of Sound Opinions. It's a critical time for the music industry. It needs to get its act together, never more so than now, Jim. Record sales are in the toilet once again, but hip-hop sales in particular are nosediving. Rap is down 44% since 2000 and 33% just this year alone. So hip-hop, which was really viewed as the new art form in the late 90s, hip-hop was dominating
keeping
the commercial
the industry
mainstream.
Afloat.
Now it's nosediving, and I think the issues that you're talking about just a few minutes ago are part of the problem. There's a sense that all these issues that drove the rap commercial surge 6, 7, 8 years ago are played out. People have seen enough videos with scantily clad models drinking Cristal with the hip-hop superstar with the bling encrusted jewels all over himself.
Glorifying gunplay and drugs and the whole shtick.
So, you know, what's going to happen now? 50 is one of those artists that has sold more than 10 million records at a pop for the industry. He's coming back. He needs to prove himself again. Kanye is sort of viewed as the future of the industry. He's the guy who represents kind of the normal everyday guy who happens to be making a rap record, a middle-class guy who makes no bones about it. I'm not a gangster. I grew up, you know, middle class on the south side of Chicago. That's what I'm going to rap about.
Which, let's face it, you know, is a much more identifiable upbringing to the vast majority of African Americans in this country, or people, period, than 50 Cent's glorified drug dealer and all of his, you know, getting shot and thuggery on the streets. Let us dive into the music. We're going to start with 50 Cent and his album Curtis.
Respect comes from admiration and fear. You can admire me or you could catch one of your wig. You see the testosterone, see the toasters right on my lap. So if it get out of line and get, I got an arsenal of infantry. I'm built for this mentally. That's why I'm the general. I do what they pretend to do.
I'll Still Kill, a track from the new 50 Cent record, Curtis. Curtis Jackson III has spent a great deal of time doing shady things in his life and makes no bones about it. He was a crack cocaine dealer in New York City. He was shot 9 times. He was stabbed. He's been in trouble with the law. All the while was able to manufacture a very credible hip-hop career as an underground artist that first caught the ear of Jam Master Jay of Run DMC and then Eminem. Got signed to a major label deal, put out two records in 2003 and 2005 that both sold multi-millions of copies, sort of redefined gangster rap in a New York City image. At the same time, Jim, an incredibly astute businessman. Forbes magazine recently estimated his personal fortune at $32 million. I mean, this guy's got his imprint on everything. He's got, you know, he's done movies. He's got a gym shoe line. He's got vitamin drinks. He's got condoms.
The vitamin drink's the one that kills me. What do you think of? Every time I think of a vitamin drink, I think of a guy who's been shot nine times.
Think of 50 Cent. Yeah, absolutely. Not only that, he is a master of creating hype, creating these kind of false feuds with people like Ja Rule and The Game and Cameron and most recently Kanye West to build up hype behind his records. So as a businessman, 50 Cent has sort of established this kind of thug persona as businessman to a, you know, the highest degree. He's sort of taken what Jay-Z has done and given it an even harder street image to help sell his records and create the 50 Cent brand, to use a really noxious term.
But does it work as art?
Exactly.
That's what we care about as critics. Let's play another track from this album, which we should point out as well has attracted some major guests. You know, this guy moves units, so big name industry people are contributing here. You've got Justin Timberlake and Timbaland. You've got Robin Thicke, Eminem, Mary J. Blige. We're going to play a track called I Get Money, which kind of brings it right down to the basics for old Curtis. Here it is on Sound Opinions.
I get money, I get money. I took quarter water, sold it in bottles for $2. The Coca-Cola came and bought it for beans, that's for some. Have a baby by me, baby, be a millionaire. I write the check before the baby comes. Who the hell cares? I'm stanky rich. I'ma die trying to spin this kid. Southside's up in this bitch. Yeah, I smell like the boat. I used to sell soap. I did play the block, now I play on boats. In the South of France, baby. Sandro pay, get a tan, I'm already black. Rich, I'm already that. Gangster in LA. Hit a head in the hat. Call that a little rap. Yeah, quit the chit chat and the big car, bake the bread. A barber, I cut your head. A marksman, I spray the lead. I blood clot, chop your leg. Not wanted with the kid. I get biz with the cig, I can really live. You dig? I get it.
Ah, yes, the ever eloquent Curtis Jackson III with I Get Money from his third album, Curtis. Greg, I hate this record. I really hate this record. I get crap sometimes from listeners and from readers saying, you know, you just don't like gangster rap. That is not true. I do believe that art can be made out of the subject of drug dealing and living a violent life on the streets. I've liked two albums in the last year that really blew me away, Ghostface Killah's Fish Scales and the last record by The Clips. I mean, in those cases, you had stories of drug dealing and violence and with all the sexism and the misogyny and the part of that world with a novelistic detail like Jim Thompson or Iceberg Slim, whereas Curtis Jackson here is a cartoon character, and it's a bad cartoon. It's not a parody, although it plays like one. His obsessions are money. I'm going all the way to the bank. I'm laughing all the way to the bank. I like to kill people. I like to be violent, you know, disrespecting women every which way. He's not saying this with any humor. He's not saying this with any insight into the human condition. No originality. No interest in the rhymes. I don't think he's a particularly great rapper. You know, the guy's got an ear for hooks. That's all he's got. But these hooks were all done in the late 80s. You know, they're all a decade and a half, two decades old at this point. We've been here, we've done this, and it's been done much better. And as far as I'm concerned, 50 and gangster rap are played if this is considered the paradigm of that form.
Well, it's a cynical record in that his two previous obsessions were guns and hoes. Now he's added money to the list of things that he's obsessed with. And it's equally obnoxious. I mean, his tone as a vocalist is consistently deadpan throughout this record. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of joy in this record, nor any tenderness. The only time he lets his guard down a little bit is on that sort of ballady song, Follow My Lead, with Robin Thicke on it. Otherwise, we are talking about a guy who's got to prove himself. I'm the hardest guy on the block. I'm going to walk down your block, and I'm going to kill you.
Right.
That's essentially the message he's sending in this record over and over again. The hooks yes, the man had the hooks for a long time. He's an established songwriter. He's probably one of the better known and most successful hip-hop songwriters of the last 5 or 6 years. He established the game with the songwriting on The Game's debut record, yep, in addition to creating a number of hits of his own. But the hooks here, Jim, are lame. That single that he released, Straight to the Bank, with that staccato, ha ha ha. He's lost his touch as a hook man, and as a result, there's really no reason to listen to this record. It's incredibly cynical. What I'm saying is the hooks that this guy was once known for are lacking, and then you're left with the content, which is abysmal.
It's a trash it record, no doubt about it. Buy it, burn it, trash it, right? Same
absolutely
page here?
Absolutely.
On the other hand, in the other corner, we have this man.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Wake up, Mr. West, Mr. West, Mr. Fresh, Mr. By himself, he's so impressed. I mean, damn, did you even see the test? You got D's, D's, Rosie Perez, and yes, barely passed any and every class. Looking at every tag, cheated on every test. I guess this is my dissertation, homie. This is basic. Welcome to graduation. Good morning.
That is Chicago and Kanye West. This is my dissertation, he says on the opening track of his third album. Graduation is the record. Good morning is the song. What an opening track that is. Greg, this guy has come out of nowhere, really just in 3 short years, and established himself as one of the biggest production forces in popular music today, working with all sorts of artists, scoring huge hits for them, and establishing himself as a significant rapper. Although many people in the hip-hop world say, you know, he's got a stilted flow, he's not really a great rapper, but boy, he can craft those hooks. I think over the course of these 3 albums, he's established that he can rap. Graduation is him proving himself once again, or trying to. He's all over the map. He's working a little bit with John Bryan, who made such a big impact on that last record. He's got all sorts of interesting samples on here. Everything from Can, Sing Swan Song, the German art rock band of the early 70s, part of the krautrock movement, to Laura Nero. Wow, it's a smorgasbord. It's hard for me to even talk about it without giving my opinion, but we want to play a song first and then get into the musical goods here. It's always a good sign when we have a 10-minute conversation about which track we're even going to play, because we wanted to play like 10 of them. We chose Flashing Lights. Here's an indicative moment from Kanye West's third album, Flashing Lights, on Sound Opinions.
But she believe in shoes and cars, wood floors in the new apartment, couture from the store's departments. You more like love to start-ish. I'm more of the trips to Florida, order the hors d'oeuvres, views of the water, straight from a page of your favorite author. And the weather's so breezy, man, why can't life always be this easy? She in the mirror dancing so sleazy, I get a call like, where are you, Yeezy? And try to hit you with the old wapty, till I got flashed by the paparazzi. Damn, these niggas got me, I hate these niggas more
as
than
I
Nazi.
Recall, I know you love to show off, but I never thought that you would take it this far. What do I know?
Flashing Lights from the new Kanye West record, Graduation. That is a classic steppin' song, as they say on the south side of Chicago.
Explain that to America, Greg,
Kanye,
for those who don't know.
Well, anybody who went to a South Michigan Avenue club in the 70s or 80s heard a steppin' song, and it's basically a dancing song. It's a classic dancey song.
Slow dance.
In the Dusty's tradition of Chicago soul music.
Thank you.
Soul music in Chicago, tremendous tradition here. Doo-wop in the 50s, soul in the 60s with people like Curtis Mayfield and the Shy Lights in the 70s. Kanye West is very much in that tradition. He grew up listening to this music. It was part of his household. He is bringing it up to date for the 21st century. At the same time, he's an innovator, you know, using those synth samples on this record and steeped in the Daft Punk mode. He became obsessed with Daft Punk in the last year. And those keyboards are, I think, the key to the sound of this record, whereas the previous record was very much steeped in those orchestrations by his collaborator, John Bryan. This is very much a stripped down, more of a stripped down record in that regard, but very, very keyboard heavy. And those tones, those keyboard tones, the richness of those keyboard tones are the key to the sonics on this record. Lyrically, the guy's stepping up. He has a tendency on this record, especially the Graduation. Okay, I am stepping out into the adult world, and people are dissing me. You know, I'm a big target now. There's a big target on my forehead. There's a little bit of petulance in this record, like I'm not getting the credit I deserve. You know, you got to stop beating me up. But at the same time, I think what redeems it is his sense of humor. There are little throwaway lines in this record all over the place that make me laugh.
Kanye West's
sense of humor is really worth paying attention to.
I'll give you my favorite. I'll tell you how long I've been on you since Prince been on Apollonia, since OJ got Isotonas. I mean, that's incredible.
You know, the little aside in a song like Good Life where he talks about them seasoned haters give me salty looks, lorries.
You know?
I mean, just a little aside, and you just like, he just threw that line away.
Right.
But it's a crack-up line. So he's got those little bits in there. And then he ends the album with, I think, one of the best things he's ever done lyrically, which is a song called Big Brother, which I think encapsulates everything this guy is about.
Have you ever walked in the shadow of a giant? Not only a client, the presidito, Ola Ovito. The game getting foul, so here's a free throw. I was always on the other side of the peephole. Then I dropped Jesus Walks, now I'm on a steeple. And we know New Jack City gotta keep my brother, but to be number one, I'ma beat my brother. On that
he's needy. He's ambitious. He needs his mentor's approval. He loves Jay-Z, and yet he hates him for some of the things he's done to him. And all that conflictedness is right out front. Whereas a guy like 50 Cent is all about swagger.
The pose.
And I have no weaknesses. I will kill you. Kanye West is all about exposing his weaknesses and broadcasting them to the world and saying, I want to do better. I don't know how to do better necessarily. I'm struggling with this stuff and making great music out of it, which I think makes him a really compelling human figure, somebody that everybody can relate to.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, he first made his mark on his first album talking about, you know, I'm working at the Gap and I'm not making enough money to take the bus every day to get to the Gap, right? And that is a part of life that much more of America can relate to than 50 Cent's cartoon image of the gangster. And I think Kanye is continuing that because, let's face it, we've all shot our mouths off and been jerks at different points in time. And we have been kind of ruthless on our Chicago homeboy here. Whenever he's begrudgingly bum-rushed, you know, an award show and said, I should have gotten this prize. It's like, man, why do you care, right?
Right.
He's saying that about himself here. I can be a real buffoon. I know I can shoot my mouth off. And I'm having a hard time telling when I should, like with the Katrina comments about President Bush, and when I should just shut up. You know, but who hasn't felt that way?
Mm-hmm.
Especially after, you know, drinking a little bit too much or being the star of the party, right? You cross a line. And a lot of this album is him looking at that and saying, I've gone too far. It's musically brilliant. He's gotten beyond the signature Kanye sound, which is to take a soul classic, sample a hook from it, slow it down or speed it up, and make a new song out of that. You know, here he's creating music with Chris Martin of Coldplay. It actually sounds good. He's doing that synthesizer thing you talked about. I think his horizons are boundless. I mean, this album is really masterfully creative.
Yeah, it's a great record. And I think my only debate on, you know, how does it stack up with the previous two, which were both brilliant? You know, where do you weigh those three records? You know, is he getting better all the time, or has he made three classics? Is this, in fact, a better record than the first two? I love having those debates.
It's so different. It's so different.
Great. That,
you know, it's a great record in a completely different way than the last two.
Yeah.
I think it's obviously a buy it record for both of us. And he's got an edge to him, a creativity that hip-hop needs more of. And that if we see the end of the 50 Cents of the world and more of Kanye West, you know, bring it on.
Did you realize that you were a champion in their eyes? Yes, I did. So I packed it up and brought it back to the crib. Just a little something to show you how we live. Everybody want it, but it ain't that serious. That's that ish. So if you gon' do it just like this.
Greg, that is a double trash it for 50 Cent, a double buy it for Kanye West. We'll check in next week and see who won the feud or if Kenny Chesney trumped both of them. Just a little more Kanye under us. This is a song called Champion that's sampling Steely Dan's Kid Charlemagne.
If you want to chime in on the Kanye West or the 50 Cent albums, by all means do. Send us an email at interact@soundopinions.org or give us a call on our hotline at 888-859-1800. We're going to be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with a review of the new album by the Mekons and my Desert Island Jukebox pick.
I think he did when he packed it up and brought it back to the crib. Just a little something to show you how we live. Everything I wanted, man, it seems so serious. That's that ish. So if you gon' do it just like this. Did you living's harder than dying. For me, giving up's way harder than trying. Lauryn Hill said her heart was in Zion. I wish her heart still was in rhyming. Cause who the kids gonna listen to? Huh? I guess me if it isn't you. Last week I paid a visit to the institute. They got the dropout keeping kids in the school. I guess I clean up my act like Prince of Doom. If not for the pledge, at least for the principal. They got the CD, then got to see me drop gems like I dropped out of P.E. They used to feel invisible. Now they know they invisible.
Did you realize that you were a champion? This is the story of a champion. Runners in the mud, do they pop the gun? Stand up, stand up. Here he comes.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That is the Mekons with a song called The Hope and the Anchor from their 179th album or something like that, Greg Kot.
At least.
Natural, their newest release. Actually, this is celebrating the Mekons' 30th anniversary. Now largely based in Chicago, the group formed in Leeds, England, way back in 1977. Only two of the prolific founding members left. John Langford, who's the Chicago contingent leader, and Tom Greenhalgh, who's the Leeds, England contingent leader. They have not been heard from in terms of new music since 2002. I'm not counting the 2004 record Punk Rock, which was a great story. They got back together and re-recorded some of their early classic punk rock singles when they were contemporaries of The Clash, because they didn't have rights to that music anymore, so they just had to record new versions in order to put it out. Now, for this recording, they gathered in the English countryside, and according to their own bio, they, quote, drank whiskey all night, listened to the Rocks — by that they mean Stonehenge Rocks — and the Stones — by that they mean the Rolling Stones — and turned into strange old frequencies. In other words, that Led Zeppelin III kind of mode. Mm-hmm. We're in an English cottage, we're in the countryside, we're getting soused, we got a fire going, and we're going to have a back porch hootenanny, which for the Mekons means that they're drawing on elements of American roots music, Celtic folk, country, rock, the punk that's part of their past, all of that and more. Let's play a song from this record, I think, that's typical of many of the recordings here. Again, all done first take, largely recorded live, with the whole group sitting around in this cottage. This is a song called Dark, 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 which features Mr. Greenhalgh on vocals on Sound Opinions.
The twisted trees sing dark, dark, dark. Broken branches hidden far down below. The trees stare back and we burn.
Dark, Dark, Dark from the Mekons' new record, Natural. Dark, Dark, Dark being not only what they saw when they looked out their window at night, but I think a state of the world as yeah. far as the Mekons are concerned. This is a band that has always, you know, reflected its times in a very unconventional but yet very poignant way. They're a political band, but yet they're not about strident political statements. It sort of seeps into the music. This is, I think, Jim, one of the bleakest Mekons records and also one of the prettiest records
yeah,
they made.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful record, at the same time a very dark one. It's interesting. You know, I think they took Whitman and Thoreau to heart and said, let's get back to nature and mm-hmm. let's commune with the trees. Well, in that song, even the trees look kind of menacing. It's yeah. like the planet's rebelling against them, too.
I think it's the best threatening trees song since The Trees by Rush.
Absolutely. So there's nothing left. I mean, the world is rebelling. The end of the world is near. Nature has had its fill of the human race as well. So they're huddled together in this room trying to make this, it's kind of like a last refuge kind of scenario, you know, the last days of the planet, and we're making music together, and it's beautiful. What the Mekons do so well, and as you said, they've dabbled in all these different types of music, reggae, honky-tonk, folk, punk. They've expanded way beyond being just contemporaries of the Sex Pistols and the Buzzcocks into being this really all-encompassing band. What they do so well is they take that drone, and they love their drones, those droning violins, those droning voices, and they layer these kind of very simple but evocative melodies over the top with really cutting lyricism. They're brilliant at that, and I think this record really distills what they do best in that way. It's, you know, these are a dozen kind of very dark, dark, dark songs, but at the same time, there's a beauty in it, and I think it encapsulates what this band has done so well. 30 years on, Jim, this band is still doing great work, which
Absolutely.
I think is a real compliment to them.
That is a plus and a minus, Greg, because I often empathize with younger listeners who have heard for many years that the Mekons are great. Where do you come in? Okay, I came in midway through
right.
with So Good It Hurts in 1988, and that was a largely acoustic record done for Minneapolis's Twin Tone label at the time. I think this album has a lot in common sonically and thematically, so it resonated with me. Look, I know the Mekons can be daunting. We made a joke. I don't even know. I can't count how many albums. Can you?
Yeah, I think it's like 17 or 18, remarkably enough. But
all right,
there's all sorts of bootlegs out there.
Well, and the problem is 17 or 18 actual Mekons albums, but then, you know, Langford has six or seven bands of his own.
That's a
and
side
everybody
project
has,
will kill you.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So you're talking literally in the hundreds of records. Where do you start? This is as good a place as any if you've never come into the Mekons before, because it is wonderfully pretty, gorgeous music that has plenty of entrance points. It's you know, not off-putting in any way. You could start here with this being your first Mekons album and really go in any of the directions that they've explored throughout the previous 30 years. You know, it's a great record. I think these guys are absolutely a national treasure in two nations.
Yeah.
In the British Isles
Bi-continental.
And in America now. It's a buy-it record as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together. Stranded, I'm so far from home.
Stranded, yeah, I'm on my own. Whenever possible, either Greg or I like to take a turn at popping a quarter into the Desert Island Jukebox and playing a track that we can't live without. Mr. Cott, it's your turn.
Thank you, Jim. Talking about the Mekons has gotten me thinking about what an accomplishment it is to make great music for as long as a band like that has. 30 years, incredible. Rock and roll, however, really is the story about bands who barely existed for more than a year or two and maybe made one great record if they were lucky. And one of the bands that I want to highlight today is exactly that story, the Johnny Burnett Rock and Roll Trio.
Mm.
Not really a huge name, but in a brief period in the mid-50s, this band was all that. And it really comes down to one recording session, really. In July 1956, they went to Owen Bradley's Barn Studio in Nashville. It was a band out of Memphis, Tennessee. Two brothers, Johnny Burnett and Dorsey Burnett, with their friend Paul Burleson on electric lead guitar. And the three of these gentlemen went into this studio to record some music. Sam Phillips rejected them, said, hey, you guys sound too much like Elvis Presley. I'm not going to worry. I can't record you guys. So they go to Owen Bradley. He records them. They make some groundbreaking music in these few days at the Barnes studio. And break up about a year later. Really never went anywhere. The Burnett brothers actually ended up writing some music for other people that actually brought them some money and some fame. Ended up dying young. Paul Burleson's the only surviving member of that band. And Burleson is really the one who makes this record. Burleson loosened an amplifier tube to get this fuzz effect on his guitar that was absolutely groundbreaking. I mean, consider that this was 1956. Tuned down the top two strings on his guitar an octave and created this sound that really was like nothing else in the whole rockabilly scene. And then Johnny Burnett on lead vocals, just an absolute wild man jumping out of his skin. I mean, Sam Phillips may have been right. Maybe this guy did sound a little like Elvis, but I got to tell you, Elvis never went as far as this guy did particular vocal. I mean, it is a primitive, primal scream that is the essence of what rock and roll was about in the mid-50s. It's a song called Train Kept a Rollin' that's been covered numerous times, and Led Zeppelin opened every one of its shows with this song in 68 and 69. The Yardbirds covered it. Aerosmith covered it. Motorhead covered it. It is a great song. It's actually a cover of an R&B song by one Tiny Bradshaw. But when the Johnny Burnett Rock and Roll Trio did the song, they defined it, and it's their version that everybody's been copying. So it's the Johnny Burnett Rock and Roll Trio with the Train Kept a Rollin' on Sound Opinions.
I called a train, I met a dame. She was a hipster and a real gone dame. She was pretty from New York City, and we trucked on.
Johnny Burnett and the Rock and Roll Trio with Train Kept a Rollin' on Sound Opinions. Jim, we're going to be back next week with an interview with one of the great bands of the last 25 years, the Flaming Lips.
As always, Greg, Sound Opinions was produced by Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn, with our executive producer and fearless leader, Tori Southside Malatia, who I heard is starting a feud and a beef to help out Britney Spears on her new album. I don't know what that's about.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. Now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hi, I'm listening to your show about the greatest lead off tracks in rock history. And my name is Nick Ciccone. By the way, I'm from Toledo, Ohio. And I think one of the greatest lead off tracks, at least in my mind, is Hell's Bells from AC/DC's album Back in Black. that's the tune, the tone, and the mode for the whole album. Thanks. Hey guys, it's Steve Wilson in lovely Great Lake, Illinois. I love the show. I especially love the show about lead-off track. Long live the album format. The track that did it for me was the Absolutely Sweepery by Jason and the Scorchers off Reckless Country Soul. You know, when I first heard that song about 20 years ago, it completely changed the way I listened to music. It changed how I opened my mind to music I might otherwise thought I didn't like. And it's changed what I've listened to for the last 20 years. So that's my thought. Thanks a lot.
Hi, this is Michaela Moyer. I am from Inverness, Illinois, and I would like to voice my opinion. Personally, the best is Interpol from their first album, Turn on the Bright Lights. The song is Untitled.
Hi, this is Brian from New Jersey, and I'm calling to talk about the great starting tracks for albums. One I think you guys forgot was Bone Machine off the Pixies' Surfer Rosa album. It begins with this great inside-out drum beat, and by the time you actually get the beat, you get your foot stomping to the back beat, it stops. And there's this great dissonant harmony between Black Francis and Kim Deal on the line, "Your bones got a little machine."
Your bones got a little machine.
Then it kicks back up again, and it's just the sound is cavernous and huge. And you said that Plymouth Teen Spirit is the song that launched the alternative revolution. Well, Kurt Cobain said he was just trying to rip off the Pixies. So if it wasn't for Bone Machine, there would have been no Smells Like Teen Spirit. Just what you said, thanks a lot.
All right, this one's for all the metalheads out there who tune into you guys every week. Metallica's Master of Puppets, the last piece of vinyl I ever bought. Purchased it at an independent record store, rode my dirt bike there to go get it when I was 14. Those opening chords of Battery set a whole tone for that album, which never lets up. It's total aggression, just an assault on your ears. Great opening song, great album. They suck today, but hey, it was good stuff. Take it easy, guys. Love your show.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.